it's not a thrilling narrative, you know, to put in a story. Like, sensible people work for 5 to 10 years building up a diverse client base to support their occasional independent projects.
This is Up, Up, Down, Down, the show about the art and craft of video games. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today is Nigel Brook, a 15-year veteran of the games industry, having worked for Radical Entertainment, later Activision. He's now co-founder of Steam Clock Software. Hi, Nigel.
Hello.
Also joining us today is Adam Atomic Saltzman. Adam is a ridiculously prolific game developer, having worked on many wonderful indie titles such as Cannibalt, Fez, and Hundreds. He's also the creator of Flixel, a popular Flash game development framework. Hi, Adam.
Hello.
It's great to have you.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. So the topic today is collaboration and sustainability in game development, which sounds like, you could have like a course and some weird MBA or something like that about that. But what we want to sort of dig into is the market in the indie world of how you are able to actually build a sustainable business is very different than it is. And we spend in the AAA world, and we spend a lot of time talking about AAA games. They get a lot of the marketing budgets and the flashy ads and things like that. But the indie world is a very different one, and you've been very successful, or at least from my perception, I would say very successful at finding sustainability and being able to build game after game using this sort of collaborative type of workflow where each game you're working with different people rather than the classic, okay, well, I'm going to hire 10 people and hopefully we don't go bankrupt kind of thing. So did that start intentionally, or was that a random, basically, you were lucky and kept doing it kind of thing?
It's a little bit of both. Like, I think it's pretty easy even for me to kind of like look back, because I've been working independently in one form or another for like 8 years now or 9 years, something like that. And it's pretty easy for me to look back and go like, yeah, man, this has been working really, really good. I must be good at this. And then I remember like the 4,000 horrible mistakes that I made like on the road to getting here. And so like for me, like the collaboration thing, like it's been something that I've always been interested in. And like if like from watching other like indie game teams or indie game studios, I can kind of see how people, you know, occasionally there are people who are drawn to working with each other and it kind of doesn't matter what they work on. And then there's lots of other people who are just kind of drawn to a project. Like, you know, there's a piece of work that really speaks to them and they want to contribute to it. And, you know, as like a indie developer or freelancer, you have the flexibility to kind of indulge that sort of thing if that's what speaks to you. So, but again, like I've made so many horrible mistakes since we started doing this. But that's kind of where I've ended up, is this very like our like company's like legal organization at this point is really just my wife and I, my wife Becca and I, really just we own the core of the company, and the company technically owns all the IP. But then we just go find people who we think are good fits for a particular project, and we do the thing with them and we share a lot of the revenue, and then, you know, we go off and do something else.
So the company is called Finji, I believe. And this is something you started pretty recently. Was there anything interesting, a story behind what made you decide, like, rather than just being Adam Atomic doing this and that in collaboration with certain people, that you would start to go the route of, what looks to the outside is kind of like an indie publisher type format?
Right, yeah. So there's a bunch of weird things about this. So one is like I've had a couple of companies for the last like 5 to 7 years. And we sort of had a company that we're using as a kind of an umbrella for contract work that I was doing. Which is something we're probably going to talk a lot about over the course of this hour, because it's one of the things that keeps us kind of sustainable. And I had a kind of one company, like one shell that was for contract work and like my independent like Flash experiments. And then we had another company that we're using to do iPhone game development and iPhone game publishing. we've been really eager, really for a few years now, to try and bring all of those experiments and all of these like different companies or identities or whatever, and try to put them in one place and under, you know, all, like these previous companies that we had been putting together or working under were like very ad hoc in a lot of ways. And not, they didn't feel like something that we owned or that we were attached to. So it was kind of this like mix of like, oh God, all of our work is like a big crazy mess and we have all these different identities and it's like, it's confusing for us. It's got to be confusing for other people. Maybe if we bring everything under one roof, there can be more shared resources and we can hopefully, you know, do a better job of like the, our quote unquote publishing work or our partner work or whatever you want to call it. Maybe that can get better and we can have more time to focus on what we like and we can put it all under a banner that we're actually really proud of. And then eventually after like a year of terrible things, we finally got Finji to happen.
Are there any terrible things worth talking about, or is that the sort of hidden history that should stay hidden?
I think a bunch of that stuff might stay hidden for a while.
So I guess maybe another way of asking that question in an incendiary way is, it seems from the outside, like in my imagination, mostly only having worked on teams that were sort of either well-established or I established the team myself, either by hiring them or being hired into it, that the requirements and everything are generally well understood. It's like, okay, you're going to come and you're going to put your butt in this seat for, you know, 35 to 90 hours a week, depending on how sane your company is, and you're going to type code or you're going to make art or you're going to, you know, do whatever it is you're going to do. But in these sort of indie collaborations where I see, you know, this is not just yourself, although definitely you're one of the people that I see is like quite prolific with this, but a friend of the show, Nevin Mergen, is kind of doing the same thing where he has his full-time job doing design, but he also is working on like two or three games at a time, indie games, where he's doing design or he'll do art or he'll do this or that for the game. And the thing that would really scare me about getting into something like that would be that if I'm doing half of it, like let's say I'm the programmer and I need the people doing the art, and I've heard plenty of stories about this kind of thing happening. So I am doing programming and I'm programming, and then the person who's doing the art gets kind of bored with the idea, and then it doesn't really end up, you know,
right,
shipping. Like, is that actually a common thing, or do you just end up finding people that you know well enough and you trust well enough that that's not going to be a problem?
It's kind of a mix. Like, there are people who I really trust who I know I have to kind of like, sort of like handle differently because they will kind of get bored. I think part of getting bored is like probably, sometimes people getting bored is partly because you're a bad producer, which is the thing. I'm pretty comfortable with the fact that I'm a bad producer and I'm trying to be a better producer. But I've got a long way to go. And part of getting bored is, you know, people not having, I think a lot of the time there's like communication or transparency problems. Like maybe you as a designer actually don't understand how much work there is up front, or, a thing I do a lot as a designer is I will like move my target. Like I start building one game and then I shift and I start building another game and I shift and start building another game. And there's some people I work with who are really, comfortable with that, and they understand that that's kind of like a iterative game making process thing. And there's other people who are just like, hang on. Like, I was already making art for that like three games ago game. Like, what are we doing now?
Yeah. I like puzzle games, and this was a puzzle game, and now you're making it to an action game, and that might be more fun to you, but I like puzzle games. So,
yeah. So, I think, you know, a thing that, and this is like, I've done all of those, like I've made all of these different mistakes at different times. And the thing that I'm trying to take more seriously and do better now is better communication, more transparency. And also our biggest project, we went and prototyped the crap out of it. Just me and one other person worked on it for, I don't know, 10 or 12 weeks or something like that, and made like a really ugly prototype that had a lot of gameplay. So we weren't just scoping out the basic idea. We were like scoped the basic idea, tried to fix the basic balancing stuff, tried to make sure there was a decent amount of variety in the randomly generated scenarios, et cetera, before we actually reached out and started to bring people on. And once we did bring people on, what I'm trying now is bringing them on as, you know, basically equal creative partners. So not necessarily bringing an artist on and having them submit work to me until I think it's okay. Like bringing an artist on and being like, this is kind of like 1/3 your game now. You know, you make this look how you want. And part of making it look how you want is going to mean changing things about the gameplay. And that's actually okay because this is all of our game now, which is kind of scary and kind of awesome.
And that's an opportunity where I would expect, I mean, Nigel could chime in, he was in AAA games for a long time. Like, I wouldn't expect that sort of back and forth to be happening in the AAA games. And AAA games, in my imagination, it's like somebody is a high up at the studio is like basically pitching to Sony, this is the game we're going to make, and it's look like this, and it's going to play like this. And then everyone basically just pulls that tug of war, or whatever you want to call it, for however many years it takes to ship.
In practice, it's messier than that, even in the AAA games industry. There's always going to be a certain amount of collaboration in figuring out what's fun, right? We've talked about that's sort of the classic problem of video games, is that you don't know for sure whether or not something's fun until you've kind of finished building it. And if you finish building it and it's not fun, then you need to sometimes take pretty drastic action to make it fun. And so you'll certainly get times in big games where significant elements are just one person on the team who's like, hey, I think this would be cool. And they try it and it is cool. And everyone looks at it and is like, yeah, that's cool. We got to figure out a way to do that. It's all hidden. Like, that's the thing that's different about the AAA world is any of that stuff goes on behind closed doors and very rarely leaks out into the light of day. Some of that's just the paranoia of those companies that do that. Some of it's that, you know, there are real legal reasons why that stuff can't come out. You know, something like, not as much on the game design side of things, but certainly on the technical side of things, there's a lot more collaboration going on between different game companies that would appear on the outside, because a lot of it's confined to places that just aren't publicly accessible, like the developer forums for a particular console manufacturer, where, you know, people whose games are nominally in competition with each other are like going back and forth trying to figure out how some broken API from Sony is supposed to work or something like that. But no one can ever see that. Like, that's all completely hidden. Whereas in indie game development, you don't have the, you know, you don't have the lawyers hovering over you all the time saying, no, you can't tell anyone that this is going on behind the scenes. And so you get to see some of that, you know, some of how the sausage gets made out in public.
And a lot of that's kind of like a thing that we end up falling back on almost as a marketing thing. Like, it's such a, it's so important. It feels so important to kind of like differentiate. You know, you don't want to go into combat against, you know, a bigger company. You don't want to be in competition with a much bigger company with much more resources. You don't want to try to compete with them on their terms. And so I think actually a lot of indie devs are even sometimes like there. I definitely know devs who are more open than they're maybe totally comfortable with, but because they know it kind of like sets them apart and makes their work more interesting.
To me, that's been kind of the big shift that I've noticed in indie game development in the last couple of years, is that tendency towards like collaboration with the end user in the form of Kickstarter campaigns and, you know, pre-release access to games and stuff like that, which is something that even in the indie community, you wouldn't necessarily have seen that level of openness like 5 years ago. You know, people tended to say, all right, well, yeah, we're not gonna, you know, we're not going to be as secretive about it as a big game company is, but we're still going to like make the game. And when we're done making the game, we'll release the game to people and collect their money for it, as opposed to, you know, as soon as we've got something that you can conceivably play, we'll charge a little bit of money for it and have a back and forth with the customers and try and get them to help us fund the development of it and also try and make the best game that we can that's going to appeal to what they want. And that's something that's really, I mean, it seems like a strange way to do business in a creative enterprise. Like, it's something you don't really see a lot of in other creative fields. There aren't really collaborative films or collaborative novels or anything like that. I mean, maybe the closest example would be like, like in theater, you do have the whole like improv comedy kind of subgenre of theater where you bring the audience in and you get them to yell out words at you. And then you make up a skit based on the words that they've yelled out kind of thing. Right. It's definitely something unusual, but something that it seems like to me as an outside observer, like it's really changed the way that indies do business in the last couple of years.
It is. It's a weird thing too. Cause like, so there's a really cool thing about it that I like, which is that it is like, it helps, something that I think a lot of indies are concerned about all the time is like communicating this, like almost like meta message of, hey, games are things made by people, because like, that's still not an idea that's like widely conceived of or held. You know, like
when I realized that when I was a kid, it was like one of the biggest epiphanies of my life. I was like maybe in grade 7 or 8. And I was like, wait a minute, these games were made by people and I'm a person. That was just like, that changed the path of my entire life when I realized that. But it's something that, you know, well, Apple does this too. It's like they want it to just seem like the company just output this polished thing. Fully formed.
Well, and there's something to be said for that. Like, because the other tricky, so, well, I mean, I guess I think it's great that is happening. Like the process should be open. People should be learning that like, oh yeah, sometimes game designers like make mistakes. Guess what? That's like 90% of the time, right? Like that's the thing that people should know. Cause I think it's interesting and it humanizes the process, but there's this other tricky balance that, quote unquote gamers are already very, like possessive, audience. Like they're almost by definition, if you're a big enough fan of a video game to want to be involved in its development, you already have all of these like fan attributes of possessiveness that you would have in any other form of media, but it's almost like multiplied or extra because video games are still a little bit niche in some ways.
And video games are really long too, right? Like you might really love a film, but you spend 2 hours watching it and you maybe watch it like a few times, but you're not going to spend 1,000 hours playing World of Warcraft.
It's like, imagine like if the vast majority of film was cult film instead of like pop film, like that's the kind of status or the functionality of most like people who are into games enough to, you know, want to follow development, they're essentially like cult film fans, but that's all you have access to. That's all you talk to. And like, I think there's, Night in the Woods, which we're sort of like peripherally involved with. I think they did, Alec and Scott did this like miraculous job of handling this, like, where do you draw the line? Like, where does your game stop and their game begin kind of, and how do you draw that line in like a friendly, organic way that like lets people get involved, but still kind of like carves out space for your game that you're making and that you're going to share with people. And I don't know, like, I don't know how much they did that consciously and how much it just sort of happened because, Scott Benson, one of the co-creators, you know, comes from this background in animation where there's a lot of fan culture and stuff. And he'd run big collaborative projects before. And so maybe this just comes naturally to him, but like watching that process evolve, I just felt like, wow, like they get that this is like a thing that you have to like stake out. Like this is a thing you have to like manage almost.
for sure. Have you guys seen the the Dungeons & Dreadmore team is now working on a new game called Clockwork Empires. Have you seen that, Adam? I know Nigel's familiar with that.
No, I know some of those guys, but I haven't been keeping tabs on the new project.
So their next game is like a Dwarf Fortress meets The Sims meets H.P. Lovecraft. It's like this crazy, wonderful thing. And it's a super ambitious project for a team their size. And so they understand that it's not going to be perfect enough in the first go, and that it's quite ambitious. And so they wanted to do early access, but they actually feel like they're not even ready for early access and being on Steam, but they still want feedback from the game. So they're doing this thing that they're calling earliest access, which is like, you have to apply to be like, are you crazy enough to deal with this game doesn't have UI for a whole parts of the game and like, you know, huge parts of it are missing or whatever, but we still want to kind of learn about the things that we have in here and get feedback and stuff
yeah,
like that. And
I
so
think,
they've really embraced that, which is awesome.
I think Soren's doing that with Mohawk's new game. They're doing that. I can't remember what it's called now. Off Planet something. I can't remember. It's this like crazy, like resource based, non combative, but competitive RTS game.
Okay.
It's not on early access and it's not like, like you can pre-order the game and you can get access if you want, but you have to like fill out an NDA and send it in. And they only send out keys like once a week. Like it's a very like kind of manual hands-on process, but, bringing people in to, and, you know, like, cause a lot of this process is just like stuff that, you know, as a video game designer, you're, you know, giving the game to people to play or for people to play and check out and give you feedback, but then you're like filtering and parsing that feedback. You know, you're not taking everyone's feedback at face value and implementing every suggestion from every fan.
It looks like the game is called Offworld Trading Company.
Yes. Yep. Yep.
It looks cool from the placeholder page.
Yeah. And Soren's a straight up genius game designer. Like I think it bodes really whatever is happening with that. It's going to be cool.
The thing that worries me about this earliest access thing, it's not as much something that worries me for in the context of the Clockwork Empires folks, but I think it would drive me crazy, is that the folks who are going to join an earliest access program and be giving you feedback are not necessarily the folks that are going to go out and buy a game that they see on the App Store or something like that. And so you're this is like just something you kind of have to buy into. If you're going to be doing that, then you need to build a game, or you're going to end up building a game that is for people who are super into games and super into that kind of game. And it's almost certainly going to end up not being very accessible to people who like games but aren't obsessed with them. You know what I mean?
I think that's a risk, but also as a designer, like I think you have to, I mean, it's like, it's up to you to recognize that. It's up to you to go like, okay, we got, you know, you'll hear game designers talk about doing like, depth first design, where it's like, okay, we're going to like make the game work for all the hardcore players first, because that's the hard part. And then we're going to go back later and figure out, you know, what order do we introduce new concepts, and where do we need to stop and do a little bit of extra hand holding, and what can we do visually to kind of like funnel people into understanding more difficult concepts? Like there's a whole like to me it feels like the scaffolding or the framework or the basic approach to making a game accessible is in a lot of ways, like it's not necessarily a solved problem, and every game has like unique challenges. But that's something that I find way less challenging than actually making the deep game in the first place. If I look at something like Dwarf Fortress, and everybody's like, oh, I don't understand why it doesn't have a good UI, and it's like, because who cares? You could make a good UI for it in like a month. Like, but they're working on like, you know, simulating a living world for thousands of years. Like, let them focus on that. It's fine.
And it's the what they're into, and it's what the players are into.
Right? Yeah, yeah, big time.
Yeah.
And some of the frustration with that kind of stuff, I think, comes out of that, you know, people want the game that they want. And if someone makes a game that's very close to the game that they want, it's easier to try and harass the makers of that into making it into the game that they want,
sure,
instead of waiting for another game that's exactly what. And I think that's definitely what's going on with Dwarf Fortress. Like, that's certainly the attitude that I have towards it, is like, I like the idea, and there's definitely a lot of cool stuff there, but the game that I want is not that game.
It's like 80%.
There's something in there that there's a game like buried under there that I think I would really like, but Dwarf Fortress just definitely isn't it. And, you know, I'm enough of a critical thinker about games that I can sort of look at it and realize that and say, like, all right, I will, you know, my involvement with Dwarf Fortress will be like occasionally reading an interesting story about someone's crazy Dwarf Fortress game that they had when it pops across my newsfeed. And other than that, just kind of ignoring it, because it's not ever going to be the game in that genre that I want to play. But I think there's a segment of the community that doesn't get that, like, that doesn't understand that they're doing that, or doesn't care that they're bothering the creators of the games by doing that, or something like that.
I think that can happen, but like that force, like that weird, like, almost their disappointment, like, I think that's what drives genres as a whole. Like, I think people that are disappointed with, like, Dwarf Fortress being like borderline incomprehensibly obtuse, to the point where, like, lots of people download, like, fan-made programs that, like, run on top of Dwarf Fortress that make it, like, human comprehensible or whatever. And actually, I actually kind of like how Dwarf Fortress looks, but that's a whole other thing. But, you know, new games come out of that. You get, like, space-based DF9 and, like every other indie sim game that was been announced in the last, like, 5 years or whatever, is people looking at this going, like, oh, world sims can have all of these weird quirks. That's really cool. And I know how to do user interface design. I see, like, where I can contribute. And, like, that's where Cannonball came from, is playing Mirror's Edge and going, like, this game has the worst flow of any game ever made by a human. I'm so mad right now. I'm going to make a game that's just only the flow parts.
That's awesome. Cannonball was, and that's how I originally came to know about you. The first of your work that I saw was Cannonball. And for anyone who hasn't played it, I believe it's just now, it's had its 2.0 update after many years of being on the App Store. It's now 2.0, which is
a mere 4 years.
Yeah, basically the entire time the App Store has existed, Cannonball has been on there. But there's now 2.0, and it's on sale for 99 cents. So, if you don't buy it, then you're crazy. But it's a runner game, and which is almost certainly directly or indirectly inspired a lot of the other runner games that we now know, like Temple Run and things like that. You know, you can't show that, oh, the person who made Temple Run saw Cannonball and was like, oh, but this should be 3D. But definitely that general genre of your character moves forward and you tap the screen to make something happen, but they just keep running. I think definitely Cannonball was the game that, you know, in as far as I can tell, kind of kicked off that genre.
Yeah, I mean, I know, like, Luke from Jetpack Joyride is a big Cannonball fan, and I think Keith and Natalia both played it some as well. I think I think the game was, like, a really big hit with game designers, and, like, it was really popular on the web, but definitely not as big a hit with, like, the mobile audience or whatever. But
that's interesting. I perceive it as, like, a big hit, but I guess because everyone I know
bad or anything.
But it was no Angry Birds.
no, like orders of magnitude smaller for sure. It's pretty comparable to other. We released this Boggle clone thing about a year before Cannonball, and that both performed really well. And you know, Hundreds probably was in the same ballpark also.
Okay, that's interesting.
But the web version was just crazy popular. I had like a $1,500 server bill or something after the first month. It was insane.
Right. And so the version that was generated no revenue and cost money to run was super popular. And the one that actually makes money was okay.
Yeah, it did. I mean, I couldn't possibly ask it to do more, but I think it has a slightly bigger rep than it actually earned, in a way. I'm not sure.
Well, I mean, that's a huge thing in every type of art, right? that some of the films that we'll consider the best films of all time, or especially film critics, they'll be like, oh, this is 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. This film will change your life. And then, yeah, it plays in a few theaters, and like people who aren't really into film will be like, yeah, it's okay. But, you know, I'm just going to see some things blow up. So maybe that leads into then, you know, even when we have something that we consider in the indie world as like, you know, a smash success, or, you know, a very good example of the form is something we really enjoy, it doesn't necessarily put anything into your retirement fund. And that's when contract work comes in into the play. And Nigel and I know about this very well, because Steam Clock, we started 4 years ago to be a product company, and it is a product company. We build our own products. But to get things started, we decided we would do some contract work to help fund build our own products. And 4 years later, we're still building our own products, and we're building them based on the money that we get from the contract work that we do, which is something that, you know, we're lucky to be able to do that. You know, not everyone makes enough money out of their contracts that they can then go and build other products too. So but I think a lot of people, I think people would be interested to hear from your perspective how common that is in the game development world, because most people don't necessarily put up their contracts that they do on their portfolio page. They're like, here's all the games I made. And then you just assume, because someone's making these games, that Cannibal is like your business, and you just spend all day every day, like, you know, I don't know, counting the cash, stacks of cash that Cannibal or Hundreds is.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's probably not super clear, but like probably half of our, it's probably like half of our revenue, not for the company, but, for my share of the company, of my share of our iPhone work compared to the contract work I've done, is about 1-to-1.
Right.
As far as revenue, and as far as like money that we're able to, reinvest in making new, independent games and stuff like that.
As opposed to money that you're paying out to contractors and people who did sound for you and stuff like that.
Yeah. So people who worked on all our collaborators on our iPhone games get big shares of all of the game sales. And then whatever's left kind of like funnels into, you know, what game am I going to make next? And can I afford to have other people work on it? And how long can I afford to work on it? We easily match those iPhone funds with the contract work that we've done over the last few years. And I don't think that's super obvious. And I talk about it publicly a lot, and it just doesn't seem to, like, it's not a thrilling narrative, you know, to put in a story like, like sensible people work for 5 to 10 years building up a diverse client base to support their occasional independent projects.
Right. that doesn't make a movie. You know, he quit his job and he threw away everything just for this one chance of making this game. And then finally it succeeds. Yeah.
And to me, it's funny, 'cause like we've done lots of things that felt really crazy. Like, I quit my day job. The same month that I quit my day job, we got married and we bought a house.
Right.
And so like I quit my job and bought a house, and that felt like really stupid, but at the time, like all the pieces were adding up and it actually kind of made sense. But like we tried to do this mix of like take a big risk but have some kind of like safety line in the middle of it. So I quit my job, we bought a house, I started doing full-time independent work, but my wife kept her job with the health insurance. And we did that for like 1 or 2 years. And then finally she was able to like leave her position. And we started doing not just contract work after a couple of years, but doing contract and a mix of internal projects. And then we kind of focused on internal projects for a while, and it was working okay, but we made a bunch of mistakes, and we weren't able to support ourselves fully eventually. And so kind of like rolled back and started mixing some contract work back in. But, you know, I think we had the benefit of, you know, I had this huge benefit of, I got to work with this safety line of, my wife Becca's like, salary and health insurance that was there the whole time that I was learning to freelance. And it really panned out for us. Like we have crazy opportunities now, but you know, it wasn't, this thing took a long time. Like, I started doing this stuff like full time in like 2006.
Overnight to success takes years.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know, like, it, like, for me, like, I feel, I sometimes feel like it's a hard thing to give advice about, because it's like, yeah, actually I took a bunch of risks and we got really lucky. And this was all built on like my wife's job she got because I had gotten a job and worked my way up at this tech company. And then we were able to like hire her to do some work. And then she worked her way up there. And like, you know, we started working there in like 2003. So like, I view like, we're right now, we're getting to do exactly what we want, but it started like 11 years ago, like getting a really lucky break and getting this really decent job, like day job.
It goes back to the thing you were talking about earlier about humanizing the developers behind the games, right? That it's from the outside looking at a successful game, it's easy to, you know, see those crazy successes, like see the Angry Birds, and then see the moderate successes and assume that, you know, that the people that made them are rolling in cash or did have this crazy overnight success or are even just making a living off those games exclusively. And I think it's important both from the standpoint of people that play the game sort of understanding what's on the line for the developers, and you know, making them feel a little bit less entitled about stuff, to kind of be clear about like, yeah, this is, you know, this is a complicated thing to juggle and manage. And even being successful at it often means only making as much money as you would be making at a day job, but having that freedom, and that you're, you know, you're willing to pay that percentage of your salary that you're not making by, you know, by being the tool of the man and working in the corporate world, that, you know, you pay that difference in getting the freedom to do what you want.
Well, and the Angry Birds thing drives me nuts for so many reasons. Like, one, like, that's like, even they haven't been able to replicate that success. So like, I see it, like, every time I see another video game company out there that's trying to like, yeah, this is going to be the Angry Birds of whatever. It's like, not even the Angry Birds people can make the Angry Birds of anything anymore. Like, this is
no,
crazy.
nor did they hit it overnight. I mean, they made a lot of games.
That's
before
the thing. Like,
Angry Birds was a hit.
To me, it's crazy that like, if anybody's talking about a Rovio success story, it's only going to be about Angry Birds. And for me, like, the Rovio success story is they ran a company where they made like 50 games.
And they were making like Java games for Symbian phones and like weird, unpleasant.
if you get to make 50 games, your business is a success.
Yeah,
like you did it. Like
if you built 50 games and you didn't go bankrupt, then yeah. You know, you're all probably pretty quick at making games, or you're succeeding in some sense, definitely.
Yeah, I figure at that point you win, and like, you know, like, so you cloned Crush the Castle. And it became like this, like, out of control super hit. Like, to me, that's like a lightning strike. That's not like a success that you look at and go like, yeah, we could do that.
Well, it's actually really well kind of understood, but in psychology and things like this, that getting a lightning strike like that, if you dream of just having this one massive hit, then when you get that massive hit, it can often just sends you into depression, because then you're like, well, now what do I do? I don't know how I did that. I have some money, but that money is just slowly dwindling now and it's not sustainable. And so you get people like the Flappy Bird guy who ends up pulling his thing from the store and like running away from the internet because he just isn't like, now what do I do?
Well, and it's so easy to draw the like the wrong lessons from your success. Like, the main lessons that I learned from Cannibalt right after it came out, I practically had like a notepad file open and was like, okay, here's what you do to succeed. Make a game in 1 week, port it in 2 weeks, and then you just get giant paychecks.
Right. So then you just got giant paychecks forever.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was like, I can make like 2 games a month at this rate. but it turns out, no, like, it was a super lucky game design. And like, I did, I think, 11 prototypes like the summer after Cannibalt came out, and all of them were garbage.
Which makes total sense. But yeah, I'm sure that was frustrating to go through that process where you feel like, oh, I figured it out.
And yeah, it's actually... well, it's just crazy because, like, I know it was so dumb because, like, I knew, like, before I made Cannibal, I knew the right approach. And it was, like, even things that you know that you learned the hard way, you can have some success, and it will just, like, stomp into the room and, like, knock all your vases over and, like, take a dump in the corner and leave. And you're just like, okay, I guess that's how it works now. And it's not how it works. Like, how you had it set up before was fine. Because those are the conditions that led to the success in the first place.
So how much, I mean, this is probably something for both of you. How much do you think that the current state of what type of game you need to develop in order for it to be sustainable or profitable has changed, especially on the App Store where, but you know, it's also true on Steam and things like that. There's just so many indie games out now. Has the formula of like how good or the bar of how good something to be needs to be changed a lot? Or is it just that your sort of marketing and distribution has changed?
God, I think it's all of it. I mean, the thing that I like is I feel like there is still, I think you can still make something that nobody would consider. There's this phrase that goes around that's like AAA indie or whatever, you know, this idea of like a very polished, beautiful,
like Journey, maybe.
Yeah, Journey, kind of or thing. Even like, I think even Gone Home in a lot of ways, you know, sure. Beautiful, like fantastic voice acting and beautiful scenery and all of those things. Like the Chinese Room, their work. I think
Monument Valley, the Room games, maybe on right, iOS.
Rust, all of these things. It does feel like there's a lot of like top down pressure to like, I mean, people are going to look at screenshots, right? They're going to be in the store and like, they're going to look at Monument Valley and then they're going to look at your game and I don't think people actually work this way, but as a designer, you feel like there's enormous amount of pressure of like, oh man, my stuff does not look that good. Like what on earth are we going to do now? So there's a little bit of that there. There's a little bit of, our great golden dream of democratized indie development is maybe not complete, but has made an enormous amount of progress. And so there are way more games like that thing where everybody's like, what if everyone quits AAA and makes their own indie game? Guess what? They did. They totally did.
But
that.
Except they're also still just making as much AAA as well. Like it seems like a great time to be a game consumer in that respect, that there's such a broad range of stuff available now than there was, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, where you can have like the big multi-million dollar AAA extravaganzas, and you can have the really polished gems, and you can have the games that just someone threw together in their basement and is charging a buck for, and you know the whole set of games is available.
Yeah, well, I think, like, you know, even, like, 5 years ago, I'd sit around and be like, man, I wish people were making games about, like, survival. There's no games about survival these days. And then suddenly, like, oh, that's a solved problem. We got that one figured out. And I think that's going to, like, keep happening. And it does, in some ways, it does raise the bar because, like, when you make the first game about survival or whatever, it doesn't matter if it's, like, not the most, like, it's almost like there's this little slider where, you know, it can be very, very new and innovative, or it can be very, very polished, but like, you don't need as much polish to like capture people's imaginations if you're doing something that feels really new, or feels like a big departure, in a way that people can handle. Whereas if you're kind of like, we're making, it's a top-down action roguelike with pixel art. Like, the bar for that is higher now than it would have been a few years ago because there's, you know, I don't know, 800 of those or something.
Yeah, well, 5 years ago or 8 years ago, I would have been like, wow, a top-down action roguelike with pixel art? Like, that sounds exciting. I want to try it because of that.
Yeah.
Or just like, you know, 15 years ago, like, yeah, an indie platformer. Like, oh, cool. Or 10 years ago, an indie platformer. Yeah, that sounds cool. I like Mario. And now it's like, God, please no.
Yeah, so there's like, and all of that stuff is, in a way, all of those are like kind of false concerns. Like if you have a really solid, beautiful thing that talks to your audience and respects them and, you know, does something really interesting, like it doesn't matter if you're in a genre that's got a lot of stuff in it, you know, like, it is something that you do have to take into account when you're telling people about the game. Then you can't just have the game speak for itself. And that's like that stuff, but it's a reality of the market or whatever you want to call it right now, but it's kind of frustrating because it's one of these, you know, like as the, it's like the barrier to access to tools feels like it's come way down, but the barrier for access to audience feels like it's actually kind of like going up in response.
Well, it's tough from the audience's side because it's hard to know sometimes that there's something out there that you'd like. Like there could be that perfect game for you that someone's making and just no way for you to find it because there's so much stuff in that genre that isn't exactly what you want that, you know, so both the developer and the player need to put some effort into kind of cultivating that relationship to sort of figure out like, hey, which one of these dozen, you know, pixel art top down roguelikes is the one that's for me, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And we talk about this, like we use almost that exact language internally, except backwards. Like when we sit down and we make a game, we're passionate about it. We love it. We sit down and we actually like have a Google Doc somewhere that says like, okay, how do we find the people for whom this game is already their favorite game? They just don't know about it yet. And we never have a good answer to that, but we always try, you know, like what are these people looking for? And it's a thing that we do in playtesting a lot is like, it's a really cool thing that you can do when you sit down and you put your game in front of people that aren't you. And then you can just ask them, you know, how would you describe the game? What do you like about the game? Like, especially people that sit down and play it and they're enjoying it. You ask them what they think is noticeable about it or cool about it or whatever. And you can start to build up like an impression, like an external impression of the things about your game that are catching the interest of your audience. And then you can start to cross that bridge, but it's insanely hard. It's the hardest thing right now.
Yeah. And I've definitely had times where I felt I'd have a particular itch. Like I want to play a game that's kind of like SimCity, but it's actually like, it's good and I can play it. And it's not like crashy and I'm like, but it's like, really, it is a city building game. And I like evaluate like, okay, Cities XL, you know, has these problems and the new SimCity has these problems and this port of whatever apparently is really buggy or whatever. And so I kind of read about it and I'm like, okay, I'm certain that there's some indie developer who is making or has made the game that I want, but like my Google searching and my App Store searching is just failing horribly. I just want to like be able to upload my game desires to the internet and the games is just Steam can automatically debit me.
You want to find that one blogger who is also obsessed with city building games and who's been like painstakingly combing through everything that genre has to offer.
Right. Yeah. So before we wrap, I wanted to give you a chance to talk about, so we talked about sort of Finji and your publishing or like quote unquote publishing stuff that you've been doing and Cannibal, some of your older games. What are you working on looking forward that you can talk about as far as new games?
So we're starting to put some of the kind of finishing touches on an educational game. So this is on the contract side. Like why not be transparent, right?
Sure.
So this contract work that is supporting a lot of our internal development is making an educational tablet game that's kind of about sequencing and computer math.
Oh, cool.
And that's going really well. And we're collaborating with Alec from Night in the Woods on that. And it's just been a great project so far. And the client's really intelligent and perceptive. And it's just been an awesome opportunity. Again, like, you know, it took us 10 years to find this amazing, you know, freelance client. But now that we've hooked up with them, it's been really positive. So we're kind of putting finishing touches on that, and then we're focusing almost completely on Overland, which is our current kind of bigger, what in the, I guess you would call it an IP. But yeah, that just feels wrong. but it's our new game. It's set in a whole new universe, and it's going to be a 3D game, and it's going to be on desktops first. And it may end up being even one of these kind of like early access games with sort of, I don't know, customer audience participation to some degree. It's sort of about a lot of things that I like. It's about being like, it's about being lonely and surviving and weird things that aren't clearly identified as threats, and things that are kind of familiar but strange. And I'm really looking forward to being able to focus almost completely on that. And then we'll probably, we're kind of full. Our quote unquote indie publishing work, we just kind of put under this umbrella called partner projects. And we have our first kind of set of three partner projects, and we're doing lots of different things with them right now. And I think once the dust settles from that, I'm hoping maybe this winter or spring we'll be able to maybe take on one or two more, which I think would be cool.
Awesome. So where can listeners go on the internet to keep up with your various exploits, Adam?
So we tend to keep FingyGames.com pretty up to date with our slate of like current and past projects. We have there's like a Fingy Games Tumblr that you can find from there. There's a Fingy Games Twitter account, which I think is just at Fingy Games. And then there's, if you want a lot of tweets, you're welcome to follow me at Adam Atomic. And it's kind of an avalanche some days, for which I apologize, but there'll be lots of things. We've been on kind of like a relentless spate of announcements for the last 3 months, and I think things are going to quiet down for a little bit, but then we'll probably pick up again in the spring.
Awesome. Well, thanks a lot, Adam. Thanks for listening, everybody. We always want to know what you think, so please give us some feedback either by email, hello@upup.fm, or on the iTunes store. See you next week. Yeah, have you had in all of this crazy spate of announcements a chance to play any play anybody else's games?
Barely. what have I even? I'm trying to think of something new that I've played. I played Hitman Go. That's sort of new-ish.
Oh yeah,
That was awesome.
That's a really neat game. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I played through Super Time Force. That was really solid.
Is Super Time Force, that's the one where you got like a few different, it's like a platformer and people can go back and forth through time, and when you die you play back as someone else.
Yeah, it's pretty, like, it's got like this solid like weird Brady hook where, yeah, it's like Brady, you rewind time as far as you want, but then when you restart your past self stays there, and then you spawn alongside yourself, and you can pick any of, I think there's like a dozen different characters or something. And so the whole fun of it is getting into like a boss battle and eventually spawning like 14 of yourself to like,
and they're
fight
all
the
attacking
boss.
The boss.
Yeah, but they were really the, like, there's a lot of like goofy 80s comedy in the game or whatever, and there's like a guy who's made out of poop and his attack is farting. And it's like pretty, right, it's pretty low hanging fruit, but like the structure under that, like the guts of the game under that, when you start getting into, there are these like weird hidden things that you can only get by speedrunning a level.
Oh, okay.
And when you start speedrunning the levels, you start realizing that everything about how the level's laid out and where all the power ups are and where all the enemies are positioned and all of your character abilities are all like this really, really intricately woven mesh of things. It's a like a really, for a game that like looks totally goofy, and like over the top action, like the, when you get down to the metal underneath it, it's phenomenal.
Awesome.
Which is like my happiest thing. Like I'm never happier than like getting to play something that has a sense of humor and is willing to just be fun. And then, but when you do start to scratch at it and you find there's like not, it's not empty, you know, I can never really get into a game where it's like a pinata with no candy in it.
Yeah. I mean, obviously there's the little iOS games that you poke at for a little bit, but
yeah,
definitely if you're going to sit down and play something. And I found more and more that there's like a key amount of depth where, and that sort of genre of game that you would call like a sort of indie PC games have been satisfying that for me, where it's deep enough that I play it for a while, but not so deep that it needs like 100 hours to get through the whole thing. So I think that's, there's something kind of special there for an adult that has lots of other things to do.
Yeah, well, there's this weird trend. There's this weird thing I've been seeing in AAA where the first like hour or two of any AAA game is just this like J.J. Abrams, Jerry Bruckheimer, like just like schizophrenic train wreck of like confused Hollywood imagery. But it comes, it's like so back to back and it's so fast paced that it like takes on its own like weird manic energy. And I actually really, really like that. And then after an hour or two, it's like, it like the pace drops by a factor of 10. And it's just this like plodding, like fetch quest, like copy pasted combat encounters thing.
Right.
And then
it's like
dies for me.
They married a really crafted experience in the first 2 hours and the last 2 hours with, oh, well, this game needs to be at least 20 hours long. So
yeah, it really feels like that. And if you don't have a lot of time to play games, you just kind of you're just like, I just can't play this game. Sorry. But I got Dead Space 3 for $3 the other day. So
that's a pretty good deal.
Yeah, I'm going to really enjoy the first, like, actually energetic first 60 minutes of that game and then never play it again.
Yeah, I don't know what the solution to that is. I mean, other than buying games that are less than $60 at original price and so they don't feel the need to.
Yeah, I kind of like I haven't played The Last of Us yet, but everything I've heard about that, I think I actually would like, where it's like, it's just a shorter game. And all of the things that are in it are interesting.
If you haven't played Last of Us yet, then drop everything as soon as this recording is over. If you don't have a PlayStation, go buy one.
No, the list of things that I haven't played is like pretty. I've been catching up a little bit. I haven't played The Last of Us. I haven't played The Walking Dead. I haven't played Papers, Please. Like, it's a disaster. It's that whole there's way too much good stuff out right now problem.
Yeah, I'm sure Dead Space 3 is good and Papers, Please is definitely good and Walking Dead is good, but Last of Us is one of those like candidates for best game of all time, which I don't want to overhype it to such a degree that you're like, well, this is pretty good, but Alan said it was the best game of all time. I don't know about that, but it is one of those games that can kind of change the way that, or at least for me, it changed some of the way that I think about that AAA game genre.
Yeah, I think they might have... somebody let them do the right thing with it, I think. And I just hope there's more of that. Like because I can play a game for like 8 hours. I can finish like an 8 or 10 hour game.
Naughty Dog's really cracked narrative in games in a lot of ways. Like Last of Us particularly is like a high point of the genre. You can even see that with the Uncharted games of that they've, you know, there's a particular style of like cinematic storytelling, character driven games with the story and the game really well integrated that they're just doing such a fantastic job of. And I think part of it is that in that genre, you don't have that tendency to have filler in quite the same way that you do in, you know, like RPG games or open world games where there's this real need in the market to make the game big. And so you get a lot of that filler content in them. With a narrative game, you just can't do that. Like, you can't say, all right, well, we're gonna have this cinematic game where there's all these plot twists and all this character growth and stuff like that, and we're gonna make it like 45 hours long, because it just doesn't it doesn't work anymore, right? You can kind of sit through like a 6 to 8 hour movie over a couple of nights, but you can't, you know, you can't make like a 45 hour movie.
Yeah. Well, even if you're trying to compare it to like TV or something, like there's a reason that most TV shows that have that serial scope and have a reasonable level of quality are like ensemble shows where there's like 9 main characters. And that's not a thing that happens in games either. Like, I don't know.
You look at like, you know, Lost is the first one that I really noticed this with in TV, but Lost isn't like one 90 hour story. It's like,
yeah,
9-10 hour stories spread out over,
or like 25 seasons or whatever it was,
yeah. Right? You know, like,
there's got to be games that do that though. Like, I mean, RPGs, like old, like JRPGs and things like that would have a lot of people in your party, but generally the story would be fairly like linear. Is there not good examples of games where it's sort of like an ensemble thing where you're following multiple stories at once, but you're sort of involved in them all?
I think there are probably some. I imagine like JRPGs seem like I can't believe there aren't any like that. Like, I really like the, what's his name? It's the old Quest guy. Yasumi Matsuno, who did like Vagrant Story and Final Fantasy Tactics. Oh, yeah. And all those games. A lot of those games have this kind of like operatic, like Shakespearean scope to them that, and there's lots of characters and lots of weird politics. Like Final Fantasy 12 had a little bit of that, at least in like the first 10 to 15 hours.
I'm having a hard time thinking of any games though where you actually see the game through more than a few characters' eyes.
Yeah.
Like even, you know, even something like what they do in Last of Us, where you play part of the game as a different character. Like that's really unusual for like a third person action kind of game. Or what's another one in Halo 2, where you play part of the game as Master Chief and then you play part of it as the Arbiter or one of the Covenant guys, right? And there's been like a few times like that where people have played with the format a little bit and done like a couple of characters, but I can't think of any game where you don't kind of stay in one person's shoes, or if there's a second person, it's someone that's sort of introduced as a secondary character and then you switch to them or jump over them for a while and come back kind of thing. Like, yeah, I don't think there is a video game equivalent of Lost, you know, where it's just like any one of these people could be the main character if you want to,
or Game of
spin
Thrones
the show that way. Or, yeah, example, Game of Thrones, right? Is another, a more modern example, yeah, of that.
I feel like there might be, but they're rare. These things are rare. I feel like it's possible. And then like, I haven't played them, but there's like Planescape Torment, which like has this like crazy following, and I think one of the things might be that it's got this kind of like sprawling multiple player character kind of arrangement, and there's a couple of things, but they, you know, they're games that fall into these, like they're cult and they're rare, you know, there aren't very many of them.
It would be hard definitely to do it in a AAA game where there's so much motion capture and action and facial and voice and stuff requirements, especially when if you would have actually any options to how the story goes, like, you know, who, if the leader of the party dies, then they're actually dead. And then the next most qualified person picks up the party and they're negotiating with the king, like, and there's actual real cutscenes around that. But you could imagine an indie game where the speech is written, and like some of the characters, you know, you don't realize that in your first playthrough, but you know, multiple people might use the same or similar dialogue, but their voices are like, mur, 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 you know, and then you could imagine pulling it off.
I think you guys are going to maybe like Overland.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds kind of interesting. I'm very intrigued from the piece of concept art that you have on the webpage, as far as I can tell, is the only content so far.
Actually, there's screenshots on the blog, right in there. They have some more concept art, actually.
Yeah, there's a few things from our new artist.
Is Overland the first 3D game? Like, you mentioned that it was 3D, and it looks like most of your other stuff is 2D. Is that the first 3D game that you guys have done?
Yeah, which for me, like, actually feels really weird that that's the case, because like I spent years and years doing low poly 3D modeling, you know, building 3D characters, rigging and animating, you know, doing like 3D texturing. Like that was all stuff that I had taught myself and was like my main hobby for years and years. And I ended up dropping it when I started getting into making my own games because it was just like massively impractical. Because I started making games like 5 years before Unity even existed. I'm really curious if things had happened differently.
Yeah, I mean, Unity is definitely helpful, but just the from my understanding that the process of actually building those models and especially animation is still really time consuming compared to doing like frame based animation for sprites and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's pretty killer. So we found this this artist Heather Penn who's just like just awesome, and we're kind of giving it a shot, and we have a bunch of like backup people in mind who might have to come in and like help us out if we've bit off way more than we can actually chew, but kind of giving it a shot. And we've scoped down a bunch of other things. Like it's probably not going to have hyper realistic texturing, you know, or, really, really like ZBrush hyper detailed models or whatever. Like there's just some things that we're scoping back to try and make it a little more practical and a little more stylish. But
it seems like that's a tough transition for indie games to make that we're kind of on the cusp of is moving to 3D. You know, like indie games now are sort of on the verge of the transition that AAA games went through like 15 years ago of, you know, moving to 3D being a really key part of it. And, you know, I'm worried, like I read things like the various stories about Jonathan Blow's work on The Witness, where, you know, he came off this like one man, you know, tiny project that was hugely successful and now has sunk like 3 years and all the money he made off the previous successful project, like building his next game. And it sounds like certainly a chunk of the expense was because it was a 3D game, you know, that it was so much bigger in scope in that way than this previous stuff. And there was so much other talent then that he needed to bring in to do it. And yeah, like it seems like it's a transition that could easily kill an indie dev if managed poorly.
Yeah. I mean, it's just plain difficult, period. But then on top of that, it also like there's a thing where, and I don't think it's true yet, but it's really easy to imagine like an ecosystem like you saw happen in AAA where, you know, it didn't matter if your game was really clever or had like really interesting gameplay or whatever, if it wasn't, you know, in a very simple, superficial way, if it wasn't visually competitive with its contemporaries, then there was no way to get people interested in it. And that hasn't happened yet, but I think there's a potential for that to happen with indie games getting bigger budgets and more talent and like moving into these big, beautiful 3D worlds. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah. Well, we're excited for it. Definitely keep us. I mean, you don't have to keep us specifically up to date. We'll follow the blog.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, we're going to be able to start posting lots of stuff in like another month or two. I'm getting really excited.
I was quite surprised, like when I played Gone Home, and it's a 3D game, but for an indie studio, and it's obvious that they've cut off a lot of the work from not having really many animations or almost no animations in the game, which is a lot of the cost, especially if you're animating characters. You don't actually see any moving people, so it simplifies that. But then I was reading some more about the development of the game afterwards, and the ridiculous amount of time that went into like handwriting these notes that are all on the tables, and then you sort of zoom out and then realize just how much stuff is in that house.
Yeah, and little things like I don't remember. Steve spent like a week or something just working on like how do your feet sound when you are like turning the camera in the game. And like, how does the camera bob? Like, how do all those weird things add up to like putting you there instead of pulling you out of there.
Yeah, which is more important in a game like that than it would be in a little action game or something like that.
Yeah. Like if you're not in that place, it starts to lose a lot of that special whatever, that little like suspension of disbelief or whatever.